Hey, this is Elif, trusted producer. See what I did there? I wanted to remind you to get your tickets to Chicago Podcast Fest, where the Mincing Rascals will perform their podcast on stage. They take the stage next Saturday the 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Lincoln Square. Nick DiGilio and Kelly Leonard will host their pods on stage, too. WGNradio.com/events. Get your tickets now!
Today is Thursday. It's September 28th, 2017. It is now 11:12 in the morning. I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio. And if you think this is swell, check out my weekday show Monday through Friday from 1 to 3, and on Saturdays from 10 a.m. till noon. That one goes out to Mrs. Zorn.
I'm Steve Bertrand, host of The Business Lunch on WGN, so get to John's show early at noon and listen to me, and then John at 1.
I'm Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the comic strip Prickly City and the podcast, The Prickly City Podcast.
I'm Eric Zorn, the oratorically challenged columnist from the Tribune. My column runs Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
I don't think you're oratorically challenged at all.
No. Well, here's the thing, John. Last, Johanna and I went on it. My wife.
I have to tell you,
I drove down to West Virginia. My wife and I drove down to West Virginia, and she runs the Third Coast International Audio Festival, and she's very sensitive to good speaking voices on the radio, and she began cringing at my failure to finish sentences. She says, listen to John. John talks, he projects, he finishes his sentences, and you mumble like a print journalist. And she's right, I'm going to work on that this
week.
That's
the worst thing when your wife says, listen to John.
Listen to John.
There are times where my wife will have other criticisms of what I do, helpful and coming from a loving place, and you just hate it because you know they're right. You know what I mean? I mean, I think they are our best, truest critics.
So what's John saying, Eric, is yes, he does speak better than you.
No, he does. He does. I just want to meet some sort of basic standard of finishing.
Not finishing sentences is very...
And that will conclude The Mincing Rascals.
That is good. All right, let's get started.
Time for recommendations.
At York High School in Elmhurst.
See, listen to those pipes.
A flag was displayed on the library floor. Hmm. It was roped off as part of a one-day installation on the First Amendment. The staff there hoped that that would challenge the students' critical thinking about some current events. The flag has since been removed, picked up off the floor, and turned over to the American Legion. But the heat is up in Elmhurst in Chicago.
Scott has to take that.
Sorry about that.
It's a prickly
you need
city
to look
call.
At it. It might be prickly.
Sorry.
It's my
in
wife.
Chicago, black and white.
You should be more like John.
In Chicago, black and white uniformed police officers have posted pictures expressing their views on this NFL controversy. And in each case, they've been reprimanded for either taking a knee or posing with a flag and a sign that says, I stand for the anthem, I love the American flag. And finally, on Facebook, an Elgin school board member has posted that the flag means nothing more than toilet paper to me. That's an Elgin school board member. Later, after words circulated about her post, she wrote, I cannot be embarrassed by righteous truth. Steve, what's the big takeaway this week?
Well, if you've been around long enough, right, that's the Dred Scott art exhibit that was at the School of the Art Institute.
In the late 80s.
And he's the guy who did the controversial painting, I think, of Harold Washington. And, you know, we were all up in arms then, and just like we are now. I don't know. I mean, what's my big takeaway? Something big happens nationally, and then there are ripples all around the country, and you're just seeing the ripples. I mean, each of those cases is very different, I think. I mean... The cops clearly violated their protocol,
and
the mayor said that also kind of wouldn't be very critical of them, was maybe even a little bit supportive. The art exhibit, I think, is provocative and should have been applauded, not derided.
Boy, I'm not surprised that folks who lost their poop about that.
Well, great. That's what art does.
Sure. I mean, fair enough.
And then the Elgin person seems to be off a rocker.
Oh, yeah, really? That's interesting to me. I mean, I think these things are all connected, obviously. You know, this may be the definition of a liberal view on this, but I don't think it's a wrong one. I, like Kathy O'Malley, come to the conclusion that it's a song or it's a piece of cloth and that...
Go ahead.
Well, and that what matters is not do we revere a piece of cloth or a a singing of a piece of music. It's what is in our heart, what is our intent, what is our message. And say in the NFL, the message has not been anti-American. Why can't people see that?
Well, I'm going to come from a side of, you know, obviously someone who's a cartoonist and does images. Images matter, John. I mean, it's what you imbue that material with. What if it was a picture of a slave that you could just stomp on? Would that be cool with you guys?
We'll put it in some context. I mean, I don't know. Are you saying you would never draw a cartoon that used the image of a slave? I mean, maybe there's some resonance there.
I would use it to show that slavery would be, you know, bad, but I think that purposefully...
If you drew an image of a slave, you would presumably represent that in a negative light, that slavery was bad.
Right. Stomping on something is a negative.
Okay, but you could put the image of the slave on the ground just like this flag is and say the message is the fact that the country hasn't come far enough and we still continue to treat people that way.
One thing that I think is really true about the American flag and about the national anthem is that they stand for the right to disrespect them.
Right.
And so, there, I mean, it's kind of a riddle maybe wrapped into this, but that the fact is that what that flag means to most of us is the freedom not to have to stand, not to have to sing to it, not to have to pledge allegiance to it if you don't want to.
Yeah, sure.
And so, I mean, I think so beyond the message of what Colin Kaepernick and all the kneeling players are sending about police relations with African Americans, you know, beyond these flag issues, it is a symbol. And this,
of what?
It's a symbol for freedom. I mean, it's a symbol of the ideals of this country. And so what people are saying is that when this country doesn't live up to its ideals, we are going to express that in this particular way.
Go ahead, Steve.
I don't love the flag. I love what the flag stands for. That's what's important. You can take away, you can burn, you can trash every United States flag in existence. It does no injury to me. When you start to burn or destroy the rights that it stands for, that's when I'm hurt, and that's when we're hurt. It's not the physical flag. It's the ideas behind it.
I cut you off, Scott. You were about to say
something. Well, I was also going to add, and I disagree with Steve here. I think the flag does stand for something. And the fact is, you could put anything. You could put the flag of Uzbekistan down there, and it wouldn't mean anything to anybody. This means a lot. And it's an act that's provocative for the sake of being provocative. And I know it sounds curious coming from an editorial cartoonist, but to me, there's something intrinsically wrong with that. That ceases to be art and starts to be show business.
Well, Steve did not say that this flag
doesn't stand for things.
It stands for a lot of things. And I think that one can express, you know, like I say, by not standing for the national anthem, by disrespecting the flag in some way, by, you know, I really believe that if that flag does not stand for the right to desecrate it, then it stands for nothing. So,
Well, you know where you get in trouble, though, is where, because this is what's happened. If you express the views you've been expressing, Eric, then you don't care about our troops. You don't care about the soldiers.
Right. Of course you do.
And boy, you can't get away. You cannot get out of the way of that charge. It's like being called a racist. You'll spend the rest of your life defending yourself.
And that's the idea that the flag doesn't represent all of us. I mean, the flag
represents... Or that there's a priority.
Right. I mean, the flag stands for, and I said, you know, stands for you as much as it stands for the soldier in Afghanistan.
And I think I've been struck by a historical note, and John, of course, you do your interviews with Thomas Jefferson. I'd love to know what he would think of this, is that you had a whole group of people who we honor in every possible way who would applaud this and did tear down the flag of their nation and did desecrate it and did voice opposition to that government in no uncertain terms, including taking up arms. So, you know, the irony of this discussion.
Well, it's a peaceful protest, isn't it, Scott? I mean, excuse me, if the Colin Kaepernicks of the world or the NFL players today, because of loss of free speech or police brutality, feel strongly enough about something, at least they're not throwing, you know, Molotov cocktails at cops. They're simply taking a reverential knee at a football game. How did that set the president off?
I've got to say, this one of the things that bothers me about this, first of all, that we're spending all this time talking about this little culture war instead of talking about the real problems that are existing in this country, but that now the national anthem and the flag are once again divisive subjects, so that you can't stand for the national anthem now without standing with Trump, in a sense. I mean, that they've turned this. It's like this, his whole thing about happy holidays and Merry Christmas. You can't say Merry Christmas anymore without feeling like you're echoing something that Trump has said. One of the things about Trump that is so disappointing and discouraging is what a divisive figure he is, even after his election. That he is using these issues as a wedge to try to fire up his base. And you know, that's not what a president should be doing. Maybe a candidate can do that, but a president should not be just trying to divide people.
Do you think he's consciously doing that?
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Well, there it is, 2-1.
Well, now, let me throw out this idea here.
Yeah, but it's my podcast.
And we can, if you want to use this to,
3-1.
To dovetail into the other issues. I mean, look at what over the last 10 days what he's done against the NFL. Well, the NFL denied Donald Trump the right to own a team, by the way. Does anyone remember this? So, hence, he's taking on the NFL. He goes into Texas and Florida full bore after a hurricane hits them. And because guess what those two states did in the 2016 election? They voted Donald Trump. Puerto Rico doesn't have electoral votes, probably won't vote for him anyway, and they're drowning. And finally he said, oh, yeah, that. I think for Donald Trump, it's always the personal, and that's what motivates him time and time and time again on virtually every issue.
I think, too, the most brutish thing that hasn't gotten a lot of play is what he said about the CTE and the penalties and the effort to protect the players. You know, he stands up there in Alabama and says they're ruining the game. The guy throws a flag so his wife loves him at home.
This is the same state that just gave the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate to Roy, you know, Ten Commandments more.
Right. Yeah. So. By the way, it's not my podcast. I want that stricken from the records. It's our podcast. You know, we can segue to the U.S. response to what happened in Puerto Rico. But I just want to insert this, that I find myself, because Trump is somewhat predictable and maddening, I'm really getting mad at Paul Ryan or Mike Pence or the other people who, every time the president does something that is off the charts, they stand with him. Could not Mike Pence have, on this relatively inconsequential issue, said, actually, the president's passionate, but I think he's got it wrong this time? But no, they all line up with their creative defenses of him. And Trump's always going to be Trump. If there's any hope for us, there have to be sane people in the room. And these people have no interest in righting his wrongs.
There's a historical note here, and I find it fascinating. Spiro Agnew resigns in disgrace. Gerald Ford becomes the vice president for Richard Nixon. He did not criticize the president during his, 8 months?
Gerald Ford.
Yes, while he was the appointed vice president of Nixon, even though it was clear that Nixon was going to be impeached and removed from office. The same holds true for Hubert Humphrey in the 60s. He never really separated himself from President Johnson on the war.
One of my favorite conversations that you and I had on the radio together was with Pat Quinn. Huh. I don't know if you remember when he was lieutenant governor, and I flat out said, you don't like him, do you?
Yeah.
And he wouldn't do it.
And that was so safe at the time.
Well, but it's part of his job, too. If you were elected,
with a lieutenant governor, it's not part of your job. A lieutenant governor is
they
not.
They don't run as a team.
Yeah, they didn't run as a team back then. I mean, they do in the election, but they didn't in the primaries. And Quinn and Blagojevich had no love for each other whatsoever. And that was, everybody knew that. And
he was trying so hard. And I just finally said, you know, Lieutenant Governor, you don't like him, do you? And you know, he just went on the way
he does.
You know,
but we have blah, blah, blah. We come at different angles and different skill sets, et cetera, et cetera. Is it fair to criticize the federal response? The president gives Texas response an A, Florida response an A. He says they're doing a great job with the Puerto Rican and American Virgin Islands response and that they will get an A if they're not already.
It's not just the president. How many times have you been asked to contribute for Hurricane Maria? Not many, I suspect. Not as many as Harvey, and not as many as Irma.
Well,
there's part of that, but I think there's a lot of they're not quite us to go around in this.
I think that's very much it. But I also think, let's just wash all of that aside, because, boy, that's got a lot of tentacles. At the end of the day, those are U.S. citizens, you reminded me over and over again this week on the radio, Steve. And it's not that it's a very big ocean.
It's a big ocean.
It's a really big
ocean. Really
the president,
ocean.
Explaining the failure to respond adequately, said it's a really big ocean. You can't just drive a truck down there. But you can put stuff on a boat. The problem is infrastructure and organizational on land there. That's why these people don't have water and electricity.
Well, it's part of that, but part of it is also that they saw this storm coming, but they didn't really prepare for it. They didn't realize that, okay, the shortage of diesel fuel is going to be catastrophic. We've got to get things on boats now. We've got to get ready to go now.
But they had been hit just a week before in their defense.
They had two Cat 4 or 5 storms in 3 weeks.
I mean, people are going to start dying there, I think, in pretty big numbers. Because, I mean, the hospitals are running out of fuel. The safe drinking water is not there. I mean, I really think that this called for a really ramped up response given the threat to human life there. And you see the governors and the leaders of Puerto Rico going on cable news and praising Trump, and
it's
just feel
weird.
Like, it feels like a hostage video, doesn't it? It's like we've got to say nice things about this guy, because if they say bad things, maybe he'll turn off some spigots.
Well, I think when you read about the governor there, you know that he really wants to become a United States. And he, I think, feels like the little kid against, you're such a small player that the last thing you want to do is bite the hand that feeds you right now. We played the audio this week of Ray Nagin in New Orleans going off after
Katrina. I was thinking
about
that, right.
And Nagin just lost it. He said, get your ass down here. And he really spoke to the emotion and urgency of the people. Now, the governor there is not.
That was before prison. Oh, go ahead.
Did he go to jail?
Yeah, he did. Yes. Yeah.
Sure. So, but the governor there is saying, well, we're communicating with FEMA and the president's people and everybody's work. You know, and in some ways, he's being the calm in this storm. But it's weird to see that he's not more agitated about it. And I'm a little mystified.
It took
by
them
that.
Until today, Thursday, to lift that restriction on shipping that was it was hampering deliveries of supplies.
Okay, so why am I so interested in assessing blame here or responsibility? But since the president continues to give himself an A, he's the one that started
he's
this.
He's a self-grader.
What is the grade for the federal response to Maria in Puerto Rico?
Oh, it's got to be an F. It's got to be.
I mean,
there's 100% people without power there right now. Yeah. I mean,
no, it's 91 or 92.
Oh, well, okay. Then.
Go to their house and watch TV.
I would say it's trending toward a C or a D, but it's still incomplete.
Really?
I mean, yeah, because we have to see what the long-term fallout of this is. And I'm saying I think a lot of people are going to die because of the sanitary conditions.
And we're not
going to
rebuild that
there.
Place anytime soon.
It's hard for me to say because I do think it is a big ocean, and it is. I mean, it's not a big ocean, but it is.
It's the Atlantic, but you don't have to go to Europe.
I know.
You can just go straight.
But it's also,
you can be there in
a day.
But
it is an island.
I've cruised there in a day.
It's not like, it's not like Houston or it's not like Miami that where you can drive away from or you can drive relief into quickly. It is harder because it's an island. So it's more difficult. So I think it's probably an incomplete two right now.
I'm looking at the response. The United States Armed Forces were used for peaceful purposes on the tsunami in Indonesia all those years ago. And it was overwhelming, astounding, and a beautiful moment for this country. And you're not seeing anything like that right now in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
What's your grade?
I think the correct answer is incomplete, but I haven't seen us do anything at all.
We haven't even done a Grenada-style invasion, right? We're not even to that level.
Boy, that would surprise them.
Yeah. I'm going to go.
There's a medical school here.
I'm going to go with D. I'm sure they're doing some things that I'm not aware of. But if at the end of the day, those people don't have water, electricity, or health care, then you're failing. Hugh Hefner has passed away, the iconic Chicago playboy.
What do we put at half staff for that? Just saying.
Is that a staff joke? Is that a mast? Is that a phallic joke?
It could be or not. Yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, draw that cartoon, Scott.
Actually,
put that in the truth.
Hugh Hefner was a great friend to cartooning. A great friend.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
He was a cartoonist.
I used to buy the magazine for the cartoons. Absolutely.
Oh, I did. Honest to God, I did too.
No, it's true. I agree with you, though.
I'll tell you, if you read Rick Hogan's piece in today's Chicago Tribune, today is Thursday. It is September 28th, but look it up online and read what Kogan wrote about it, because he interviewed him, and he just is a great way of sort of, you knew Kogan would write this story well, and he did.
Hefner's one of those guys, like great people maybe, or big people, who become caricatures of themselves late in life, right? So those of us who grew up with him or knew him from the 90s on probably don't appreciate the impact he made from the mid-50s on.
Vanguard of journalism and rights and progressive thinking, or was he just a dirty old man? Because the latter version is a little creepy.
That's what we know from him late, but he was a...
Yeah. It's interesting because I think if you were born maybe after 1985 or so, it's very quaint to think that this man who essentially showed bare breasts in a magazine was considered so transgressive when, you know, everyone's got access all the time to all the pornography they could ever want to watch on their computers, I'm told. So the idea
Well, so much so that they recently decided to stop showing nudes because that just isn't so novel anymore. They've gone back to it.
You talk about hotspots. 12-year-old boys, I used to know every dad in my neighborhood who had a subscription.
Okay, so what's your Playboy magazine story? You may need to think about that. I'll go first.
can't tell that one?
There we were in the fourth or fifth grade. We were living in Hawaii, fourth or fifth grade. What does that make me? 10 years old, something like that. And me and David Cook are walking in the kind of wooded area behind
throwing
our
David
house.
Cook under the bus.
And we find some nude pictures from Playboy magazine, centerfolds and stuff. And we could not believe our good luck. We had no idea what to do with this stuff or with whom to share our excitement. So we opened up the pages and then we pinned them to trees like posters because we knew that we couldn't bring them into our house. But by God, this thing deserved an audience. So if you're anywhere in Honolulu, Hawaii, near Eva Beach or Foster Village, and you happen to see pictures hanging up on trees, faded now, those were that was just my
like,
handiwork.
Just like all of us. Yeah.
Okay, anybody else?
Mine is much more repressed. When I was that age, we would go to my my aunt and uncle for Thanksgiving dinner. And their child, Larry, was older by 10 or 15 years, had his own house adjacent on the farm. So my cousin and I one time, and we were sort of not very close, or we weren't the sort of cousins to get into trouble with each other. We went to Larry's house by ourselves to play pool. He had a pool table. He had a bookcase filled with Playboy magazines. I mean, filled.
The dad did?
This was a young adult man who lived alone. And my cousin and I, neither one of us trusted the other to go to the magazines until it was 5 minutes to leave. And then we went for it and was like, oh my God, what a missed opportunity.
The cash.
I remember when I was in about fifth or sixth grade, a friend's father had a Playboy, and we got it. Maybe it was out of the trash because I remember we cut the photos out of it and we distributed them so each of us could have a few of the pictures.
Oh my
and
gosh.
I took them home and
you
I
were
hid,
a socialist then.
Wait.
And sharing.
I took them home and I hid them inside a book on my bookshelf of Alfred Hitchcock short stories. And this is, I had them there and I would occasionally look at them. Not sure what to do with them again, but very furtively looking at these photos.
How old were you?
It was elementary school, fifth or sixth grade, yeah. Same age you were basically.
Yeah.
Didn't go out
you?
And put them on trees like
pervert. We didn't. It wasn't perverted.
Mommy,
it was...
what kind of a tree is this?
Can you imagine going to walk like that? Jeff Archer, I'm throwing Jeff Archer under the bus now. His dad was a psychologist and subscribed to Playboy magazine. Thought it was fine that we had a stack of them in our what became a clubhouse. It was actually a playhouse, but we were older, so it was a clubhouse, and we were in a club. And so, yeah, we had free access to hot and cold running Playboys.
It's funny. None of our stories is solo. They're each with another kid.
Shared, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Shared, definitely a shared experience.
None of us had the experience where you look under the mattress in your mom and dad's room, and there's your dad's stash of Playboy magazines.
Well, I was older, and someone gave my dad a whole bunch of back issues, and he had them in his room. But it was older then, so I wasn't that...
Well, I had a friend who his dad in the basement where the work above a vent. I mean, well hit, and it was hardcore stuff for them.
One of my greatest discoveries was the drop ceiling in basements when you realized you could push a tile up and hide stuff on the other tiles.
So what did you find?
Well, there might have been magazines around there.
Might have been.
Let's real quick, you guys, do you have a opinion on 140 versus 280 characters on Twitter?
Yes.
And?
A lot of people talk about how we're losing our language. We're losing spelling. We're losing punctuation, autocorrect, blah, blah, blah. I don't care about any of that. I think we're just changing. But I love the limit of 140 characters. I love the Sudoku-ness of it or the puzzleness of it of making a message fit. That's just personal, and I will hate to see that go.
I agree with Steve. I think that the limit inspired people to be crisp and witty in a way that I think they're basically doubling the length of tweets. And at some point it becomes, one of the things about Facebook is people go on and on and on sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I tend to go to Twitter for some quick hits. And I like that. I hope that they keep it. But
the president of Twitter, when he announced that it was going to go to 280, he used the luxury of having the 280 characters. And then it was corrected by a lot of people online and edited down to the very same message told better in 140 characters.
Eric does the Tweet of the Week contest, which I love. And
that's
why, because it's really well-written humor or points or whatever.
I read the one that you liked to Brenda last night, and we both laughed, and you knew that wouldn't win, and I'm trying to remember what it was. Can you read my mind?
I can't, but everyone's going to have to go online to chicagotribune.com/Zorn and they can read them for themselves.
That looks like so much work. You have a tournament of 16 tweets each week, right?
No, it depends. It goes anywhere from like 8 to 20, depending on how many I see that I like.
And then you ask, and how are you finding all of those?
I have a list of about 50 people who are reliably funny and who retweet funny tweets, and I just follow that list.
You need to put, okay, I have a recommendation for you after this podcast.
Are you looking at me for a reaction to this? I don't think, the tweeter in chief, I don't think he knows 240 characters.
Well, that's the scariest thing about this, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that.
How many times can you say hashtag sad?
It's not like you can't do 1-1, 1-2, 1-3. In fact, somebody comically, my son reminded me of this, posted this week, expanding Twitter to 280 is a terrible idea, and it has 1/67. So people are already expanding past 140 characters.
And they're doing things like they're taking a screenshot of something larger that they want to say. Like they'll write something and they do a screenshot and attach that as a photo because the photo doesn't count against your character limit.
You got to admit, Trump is very sophisticated in his, he knows all the bells and whistles. His use of Twitter, beyond the rhetoric itself, the sort of technological sophistication he shows with that app is pretty impressive to me.
Yeah, he posted a video earlier this week. It was about John McCain. I got a whole column out of it, so.
I'm sorry, which one was that?
It was he did a video of things that John McCain had said about Obamacare, and his point was that John McCain had promised to repeal and replace Obamacare, and then here he is voting against the repeal bill. And it was a 6-minute and so a video of various things that McCain had said. But in the course of this video, you have McCain saying things about how the parties need to work together. You can't have something like this, that it's not sustainable. And so he was sort of undercutting his own point. So
I was watching Ken Burns' Vietnam, and they had the John McCain video where he's shot down, captured. They had the video of him from a hospital bed smoking a cigarette with his legs in casts and talking about the pain that he's in. Go from there to the medical, quandary that he finds himself in today. I have no interest in anybody criticizing John McCain for any even valid reason.
Yeah.
And that maybe isn't appropriate. You know, as a senator, his vote should matter. He should be able to discuss the issues and criticize for bad decisions that he makes. But I'm not in a mood to do that. And I get the feeling that there's some people in this country who are waiting for McCain to pass away so that they can flip that seat and make it a more solid, more reliable vote for the Republican Party. And I hate that about the
I'm just shocked Trump didn't,
right now too.
Didn't post a video of him whacking McCain with a golf ball.
Oh, yeah, sure. Oh. Yeah, let the golf ball hit him. Eric, do you want to talk to us just briefly about the Supreme Court Janus case?
Yeah, it's Janus versus Ask Me Counsel 31. It's actually an Illinois case. And essentially this case involves the rights of a unionized worker not to pay union dues if he or she doesn't agree with the union itself. And it's not just the political dues. This is all the dues. Previously we've had court rulings that say that if you're a union member and you don't subscribe to the political agenda of the union, you don't have to pay that portion of the dues that goes to political activity. This is a much broader claim, which says, I don't like the idea of unions. My objection to unions is political and social, and so I should be able to belong to this unionized workshop, but not have to pay any union dues because I don't agree with the basic idea of unions. It came very close a couple of years ago. It was like 4-4, but Scalia had passed away, and Scalia was considered to be a vote that would have been in favor of Janus and against the unions. If they manage to do this, this is going to allow people to take advantage of all the union benefits without paying into supporting the union at all. It's a freeloader problem.
Which means the unions will go away.
Which means the unions may dry up and go away.
That's kind of what it is, isn't it?
Well, it is. People call it a right to work, but to me, it's a right to freeload. And this is an issue that I don't know how you reconcile that. How you say, well, you can belong to the union, get all the benefits of being in the union, but you don't have to pay any dues because you don't like the idea of unions.
Well, this sounds terrible, but maybe the core value of unions are going away. That is, a lot of the things that they stood for and fought for, and as a society, we're progressing towards,
membership.
Better wages, better conditions, things like that.
Well, membership has gone down, and you can actually track that too. And I know this is going to sound peculiar, perhaps coming from someone like me, but you can track the diminishment of the middle class to the diminishment of union membership.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, one does go with the other. And the fact of the matter is, it's free association. I've always had a problem with forced dues paying. I mean, that's always seemed to me to be anathema to a free society, that you must join this group in order to get a job at a certain place. But by turns, if you turn around, then yeah, unions go away effectively.
Our recommendations this week: Steve Bertrand has exited stage left and getting ready for his midday show here on WGN Radio. So we have three recommendations. You guys, I got to say, we're still plowing through Ken Burns' Vietnam. I'm going to recommend it 2 weeks in a row because it's going to take you more than 2 weeks to watch the whole thing anyway. How many episodes have you guys watched? One?
I'm at 1.5 right now.
By the way, in a busy person's life, that represents over 2 hours. How about you?
I'm going to wait for the movie. No, I have not seen it yet.
It is a movie.
Oh, shoot.
And I'm telling you guys, the president needs to watch this movie. That's not a criticism of him per se. He needs to watch this movie. And it's a slog. You know, you'll find yourself watching it, and men are dying on screen, and they're Americans, and they're your fathers or grandfathers. And you find yourself looking at Facebook at the same time because it's so patient and it's so long, but it's also so important and good. And every time you watch it, you feel like you're a better educated American. Make the effort.
I saw someone tweeting about it, the latest, and talk about how Richard Nixon does not come off well.
Oh, God. You know, this is why the president needs to watch it, because and why we all need to watch it, because there are still people. We are at like now 45,000 dead, and there are people protesting in support of the president and the prosecution of the war. And who are you people that aren't here to fight for our rights? You don't love this country. And God, don't you see it resonating a little bit these days? You know, that you need to question the honesty or the intelligence of your military leaders and your political leaders is underscored in every minute of this thing.
Yeah. You say Nixon doesn't come off well.
Oh, surprise, Johnson neither.
But Kennedy doesn't either. I mean, I'm the Kennedy so far, and Kennedy's not coming off well. He's
five presidents had their hand on this. And in the middle of it all, so then there's Bobby Kennedy saying, well, I'm going to get you guys out of this. Bobby Kennedy told a lot of people in this country that Martin Luther King had been assassinated. And then there he is, this great white hope. And then he gets assassinated in the middle of all of this. How can you imagine going through something like that right now? It's stunning. Absolutely stunning. What's your recommendation?
My recommendation is Adam Selzer. I think I've recommended this before, but I'm just now really in the meat of it. It's H.H. Holmes, The True History of the White City Devil. And H.H. Holmes, of course, is the serial killer from the South Side, and he played a big role in a major bestseller, you know, Devil in the White City. But this, Adam has done such in-depth research on this book. It is fascinating. And frankly, from Devil in the White City, I never got a strong sense of if you met Holmes face-to-face, what it would be like. This gives you a very strong sense of what that would be like.
Would you like him? Because he persuaded a lot of women to take him up on his overtures, right?
He did. And he also convinced people who probably even knew better to extend him credit and give him stuff, which he would turn around and sell and not pay his bills. But he apparently was just a very solid, in a late 19th century sense of the word, a solid gentleman that could talk you into pretty much anything. So,
and built a kiln in his basement, right?
Well, there's that.
No, I mean, really, he's just a fascinating character. All right, Eric.
My recommendation is the 39th most popular podcast in the country right now. It's called Alone, A Love Story. And it's basically a memoir. It's limited to 10 episodes. And it is Michelle Parisi, who is a producer at CBC Radio. And she tells the story of the complete dissolution and crack up of her marriage. And it the first five episodes, we listened to this driving to West Virginia and back over the weekend. The first five episodes, completely riveting. It kind of falls apart a bit in the last five episodes as she wallows a bit in her own anger and self-pity. But I'm really interested in what people think of it. It's like 20 minutes, 30 minutes per episode. Really interesting listening. Again, it's called Alone, A Love Story.
That's Eric Zorn. Scott Stantis, thanks for joining us today. Steve Bertrand is on his way to do good radio on WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. The podcast is, you're right, engineered by our friend Ben Cortez, and Elif Garris is the producer. And remember, the podcast fest will feature Eric Zorn, who has been able to join us on a stage she knows all too well, the Old Town School of Folk Music stage, on October the 7th. 7th. I knew it had a sound. On October the 7th at 7
Saturday.
p.m.
Saturday.
You can get your tickets at WGNradio.com/events. Go to WGNradio.com/events and watch us do this on stage. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNradio.com. Just click on the WGN Plus tab. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus Podcast Network. The John Williams Show is taking a 2-week hiatus. Be sure to listen back then for highlights of that week's episode of The Mincing Rascals on WGN Radio.